Hello, this is Orson Welles speaking. No politics today. I mean, talk of politics on this program. This particular Sunday, our concerns are too personal for an honest job on public matters, excepting ours. This last week, the world could have come to an end for all we of the Mercury Theater knew or cared, because our show about going around the world, the one that's taken these broadcasts these last few weeks on such a merry chase from Boston town to Philadelphia, opened finally on Broadway. Any Broadway opening has much in common with a bullfight. It can be good or bad or merely boring. For the audience, the institution itself is mainly gay and gala. But as in the case of a bullfight, for the entertainers, it's a question of life or death. Kill the bull or the bull kills you. And with the show, it's kill the people or else. An audience doesn't exactly commit murder. It just walks away and leaves the show to die of loneliness. The real killers are the critics, of course. Theirs are the commando tactics. Make them yawn and they make you yell. Displease more than three of these powerful personages, no matter what the paying audience thought of your show, it's a lifeless corpse by the second edition. And now, just an ad-lib word about the show to begin with and how the show began, before I go on with my main text, which is, curiously enough, a tale of voodoo vengeance. Around the World in 80 Days was written, as you know, originally by Jules Verne, and it's an old enthusiasm of ours in the Mercury. We've been talking about making a musical comedy of it for years, and I've been sitting around people's houses, people who write songs for a living, and suggesting that they ought to do it and wishing somebody would because I knew I'd enjoy it. I got tired of that last summer and went up to Cole Porter's place in Brentwood with a book under my arm and proposed that we collaborate on it. He went for the idea, the proverbial hook, line, and sinker, and couple of extra hooks and lines thrown in, and we had a lot of fun putting a show together that finally went into rehearsal after many false starts and false promises from a couple of producers just after Christmas. Well, we had quite a time. You've heard of jinx shows. Well, we had everything happen to us. We went up to Boston, and at one point in the evening, I think there were more stagehands on the stage than there were actors. And at another point in the evening, there were five different sets appeared and disappeared before the view of the audience. It was because we didn't have time to rehearse it properly, and we had to get open because of the scarcity of theaters. And then along came the rail strike, and then in Philadelphia along came a newspaper strike that kept us from advertising. And you can bet that if there are troubles that a show can have, they aren't recorded, the ones that we didn't enjoy in the past 5 weeks. They included actors getting sick and understudies jumping in, and since I was invariably the understudy, it didn't have that happy ending that stories about understudies always seem to have. As a matter of fact, the happy ending is the thing we kind of counted on here in New York Friday night, because we had so many troubles that we were sure that when the curtain finally did go up, that just because we'd have troubles, that the melodrama would have a nice, sunshiny fade-out. And by gosh, the audience was wonderful to us. We took many, many curtain calls, and Cole Porter's wonderful songs got a wonderful reception, and we got some laughs, and we went off to Toot Shores for an evening of celebration with a good deal of relief and even a little moist-eyed with pleasure. And then the notices started coming in from the critics, and the first that we read was one of the nicest notices anybody in the theater ever got. And then the next was one of the worst that anybody ever got in the theater. And it went like that. Nobody thought the show was pretty good. It became a matter of fairly intense argument in the press. And here we are wondering just where we'll be next week at this time. Tune in next week, same time, same station, and I'll tell you. What about these critics? Well, if their wisdom is not that of Solomon, their judgments go unquestioned. They deliver the swift justice of an Oriental court. Who are these wielders of dreadful authority? They're a handful of newspaper men who've been assigned by their newspapers to cover the openings of plays. Why does their opinion matter so crucially? Well, I think we play producers can only blame ourselves. See, there was a time when a show was a hit because people liked it and a flop because people didn't like it. The critic's job was to try to come as close as possible to the judgments of the majority. The critic's opinion was respected, but in relation to its accuracy, and in those days, it was possible to check such accuracy. The views of a critic would be lined up against the views of the public, and if the critic was wrong, too often his editor assigned him to another desk. But nowadays, a critic is never wrong. Or never wrong just because he finds himself at odds with most of the audience. That can't happen. Show never runs long enough to prove such an inaccuracy. A critic is only wrong when he finds himself at odds with most of the other critics. A critic used to be like a judge in a trial by jury. The jury was the audience, and the critic was there to see that everything was fairly conducted and clearly on the record. The way it is now, if a critic says, "I don't like him, off with his head," there's nobody to raise the tiniest point of order. The only murmur of protest comes on brave occasion from the victim on his way to the axe. But it's pretty hard to ask very loudly or with much eloquence for appeal when your head is being carted off in a basket. This is the age of the ad man, and the whole world bows to the buildup. As the lights were first being turned on, this era, before the Mazda had blistered into neon, there appeared in lights on a black night in theater history the name of a critic. That's when all the trouble began. I think this critic was Alan Dale. I'm not sure of it. And I think the quote illuminated over his name went something like this: "Al Jolson's new show is terrific." I think that was the gist of it, but I haven't the documentation at hand. The irrefutable fact is that from the moment theatrical producers began starring theater critics in space advertisements, the opinions and prejudices of theater critics began to matter more decisively than any opinion or prejudice should ever matter in the life expectancy of any play. Producers, you see, spend more money in a week publicizing the critic than the critic earns in a month, and this advertising has most definite, most conclusive results. The more the names and likenesses of critics are carried over their favorable comment, the more impossible it becomes to quarrel with that comment when it is bad, no matter how fair a fight you think you can pick. There have been a number of stout-hearted tries at picking such fights in this past season. You've read about them. On the face of it, you'd think men like Maxwell Anderson, Irwin Shaw, Harold Klerman, Ilya Kazan, Ben Heck, Charlie MacArthur would be fairly formidable adversaries. But in a matter of months, the months that these quarrels have taken place in, the critics have outfaced every one of these eloquent notables without a blink. To challenge the critics is not even like tilting at windmills, it turns out. A windmill is comprehensible. It functions according to given laws, and it is the tilter who is lawless. A windmill is also decorative and serviceable. Concerning the critics, no comment. Fighting the critics is like fighting fate. It's hopeless heroics, for critical opinion has become incalculable and unanswerable, like the weather. And though we may argue about the subject, we don't do anything about it any more than we would do battle with the elements. He would fight a critic then is not so much a Quixote as a Canute. The only folks who do anything about the weather, as you know, are rainmakers, juju men, mumbo-jumbo guys, and other such practitioners of the more primitive remedies. I'm not too superstitious, but coincidence stretched out a very long arm one day and laid it on the unsuspecting shoulder of a drama critic. I hope it was coincidence that killed him. But if it wasn't, it was me. There are voodoo men, real honest-to-gosh voodoo men, who believe to this day that I am a murderer. It may be so. And if it is, I must confess to a certain evil glow of satisfaction in the knowledge that my victim was no mere prince or president, because it always seemed to me, for example, that almost anybody could have killed Hitler. My homicide was more ambitious. I've never told this story before, but present circumstances now force me to candor. I hope you believe it, because it's very true, and if I give it a sensational-sounding title, I know if you hear me out, you'll agree it deserves one. Here, then, is the tale. It is called I Killed a Critic. Little music, please. We don't have music, but pretend we're playing it. Out of respect to his family, the critic will have to be nameless, and because certain members of the cast are somewhat involved in my guilt, the show had best remain also anonymous in this chronicle of the dark deed. When I say that this was a production of ours involving a small army of real voodoo black magic experts, many of them directly imported from the African continent, the curious will be able to trace down the show and even the feckless journalist whose shadow came between us and the sun. The play was a classic, staged in a new setting, Haiti, and there comes to me even now as I speak of this matter the sharp memory of goat's blood filling the theater during rehearsal time. Honest to gosh, goat's blood. The solemn sacrifice of these animals held up our opening for a week while the voodoo drums were stretched with a goat's hide, and I remember that the cellar under the stage was loud with the hoarse chanting of the jungle. Please understand that I'm not making this up. All this actually took place. There's lots of colorful detail that time won't allow, including the bloody business of the stagehand who rashly defied the taboo clearly announced by the medicine man, the stagehand who touched the sacred goat's hide, the bloody business of the drumhead, and the hex that ended in his falling quite unaccountably from the window of his fourth floor apartment on Lenox Avenue. All of us were shocked by this sad event, but our 20th century logic forbade us to make it anything but coincidence. Indeed, I still insist that all of these matters are coincidence. It cannot be otherwise. Came opening night of this show, a brilliant opening with much applause and even a few shop windows affectionately busted by way of celebration around 130th Street, then the papers in the morning, a lot of them good. Indeed, enough of them were so good that the show ran for 2 years and was played at one time by three companies of actors. But one criticism was very, very bad. It wasn't merely a roast. It was something extra special in the line of invective. We felt its arguments were unfair. I told the cast not to fret about it. However, the voodoo men in the troupe were not to be reassured. "This man is bad man, yes?" asked one of the high priests, taking me next door for a short beer at Watson's Bar and Grill. "That's what he is," said I. "This critic is a bad man." "You want us to put beriberi on him?" my friend, the distinguished doctor of voodoo, went on. "Beriberi?" "Yeah, beriberi, so he can write no more bad things." "By all means," said I, getting to work on a pretzel. "Listen," said my friend, who, by the way, had gold teeth with diamonds in them and was known to the company as Jazzbone, whose real name from the African wilderness was quite unpronounceable. "Listen, you tell us to put beriberi on bad critic. We put on beriberi. But you are one who says this. You guilty. You accept this?" I said I accepted all right, and I finished my pretzel. "Very well," said the voodoo man. "We go now and start beriberi. Bad man will be dead in 24 hours. And just once more, ladies and gentlemen, let me assure you that all these circumstances are from life, and I've made no effort to distort them for purposes of entertainment. There are many explanations possible for the strange conclusion of this tale, but it is strange indeed and wholly conclusive. By the time I paid for my second beer, I could hear the devil drums throbbing in the theater next door. Within 18 hours, the critic in question had been taken to the hospital. The bad notice he gave us was the last he was ever to write. 24 hours after the drums started, he was dead. Now then, our show Around the World, which is getting ovations from audiences, got, besides a couple of wonderful raves, more than three roasts. These bad notices may be enough to close the show. On the record, according to averages, they'll be enough, because our payroll's high. We can't afford to keep running as long as we need to for word of mouth to get us rolling. That puts your obedient servant in the hole, way down deep in the hole. And what's worse, it throws an awful lot of nice folks out of work. The paying public cheered Around the World to the echoes Friday night when it opened, and again last night. And if those people were nice enough to do all that applauding, tell their friends, and their friends come quick enough to the box office, Around the World can last for 80 days and more. If not, well, my voodoo friends are still in New York, and I can always get them together for a special event like this one. And I wonder then if the little handful of newspaper men, more than three, who tore us to ribbons without mentioning that their opinion was at odds with the audiences, I wonder if those gentlemen will notice in the pulsing summer air the throb of voodoo drums. I'm not threatening you, gentlemen. I just thought I'd mention it. Of course, it's absurd to suggest that a playwright should have the power to kill a critic. But isn't it just as absurd to suggest that a critic should have the power to kill a play? Now I see my time's up. Thanks for letting me make my little threat. Tune in the same time, same station, next week, and if the drums are beating, you know what happened. To your obedient servant, Orson Welles.